for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Stocks fell for the seventh day in a row on Thursday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell below 9,000 for the first time in 5 years, 42% below the market's all-time high on the same day 1 year ago. This morning, President Bush will issue a statement trying to assure anxious Americans that the U.S. is working hard to stabilize the economy. And after their second presidential debate Tuesday, both candidates returned to the campaign trail to tout their own proposals to fix the nation's ailing economy. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, and Juan Williams of NPR and Fox News. We'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Well, I must say, Eleanor, yesterday was the busiest day in New York Stock Exchange history. Dow Jones plummeted 20.8% in the last six trading days, and some people say it's going to go even further. Today, it looks as though it's headed down.
Well, in listening to the various commentary before I came over here this morning, I did hear one analyst say that what the markets are looking for, what the investors are looking for, is the bottom, and that if it goes down further, that this could be the purge they're looking for, and then you can begin to go upwards. In other words, nobody knows where the bottom is. And all of these major moves that the governments have taken around the world, nothing seems to satisfy them. And you wonder how many tools are left for these governments to try to put into this. It's like a I commented to one expert that it just felt like everything was going down a rat hole. And he said, no, it's a dry well and it needs watering. In other words, more money, more liquidity is what they're looking for.
Juan Williams, GM stock fell 31% to its lowest price since 1950. Ford stock was down 22%. What does all this indicate?
Well, psychologically, I think people are devastated right now. You know, the bailout effort by the Congress was intended to reassure the American public and the world financial markets. The fact that the vote didn't go through the first time, I think, increased lack of confidence. It was had exactly the opposite effect. So even when it came back and the reform was approved, there was still this sense in there of uncertainty, and uncertainty that even that there might be runs on banks. I mean, down to that very basic Depression-era level. And now you come forward in time, and as you just heard Eleanor talk about, lack of liquidity, even lack of confidence as banks try to lend to banks and are reluctant to do so. Should the government step in, government taking over banks, Iceland, the whole country going bankrupt. When it comes to the auto companies, I mean, they have been failing for some time. And the question was whether or not the government would again step in as part of the bailout package to help them. That has not come forward.
Matthew Continetti, how valid do you think the comparisons are between what's happening now and what happened in the Great Depression beginning 1929?
Well, I think there are some similarities when you talk about 1929 and the stock market crash. But of course, the crash and the Great Depression are sometimes unrelated. You know, the Great Depression stretched throughout the decade of the 1930s, and at points it was exacerbated by government policies, things like the Smoot-Hawley tariff, for example, things like a Federal Reserve which didn't flood the money supply with liquidity, which is what the Reserve is doing now. So on the one hand, yeah, we're seeing a stock market crash. We're seeing a a financial panic, which is how recessions were referred to prior to the Great Depression. On the other hand, I think we're seeing some broader steps, including the $700 billion package to buy up these mortgage-backed securities, including this new plan announced by the Treasury to kind of recapitalize the banks, the banking system. All these things, the global rate cut, for example, that happened this week, those are very much policies that were not in place during the Great Depression and I think probably will help us avoid a similar situation.
The president has called for a special meeting today with finance ministers and central bankers from the Group of Seven. What can he do and say to restore confidence to the system, Milner?
President Bush's words have not been reassuring. I think everybody realizes that he's a lame duck, which he could use to his advantage by saying he's not injecting politics at all, that he is really wanting to do what's best for the country and hand over a sound government to his successor. But he has not been a strong presence. I look forward to his words this morning. I hope he does better. But what he is trying to convey now is that the world is going to act in concert, and that these finance ministers meeting today, that apparently there seems to be a deal in the works to capitalize the banks and to follow Britain's lead, which is basically to take a part ownership in banks. And there was a British newspaper headline that said, "We are all socialists now." And you open up your newspaper and you can read stories, you know, questioning whether American capitalism is at its end.
One is the fact that the nation and the world is unsure about who our next president is going to be, contributing to this whole unsureness in the market.
Well, to this extent, Diane, the American financial system is a leader in the world financial system, without a doubt. And what you see on the part of the American public is a total lack of confidence, not only in President Bush, but in Congress in dealing with this issue. A lack of confidence to the point now that we demonize people who were formerly characterized as masters of the universe on Wall Street and who were so smart and at all were living out on their yachts and their fancy homes. And so what you sense is that people think, you know what, we're not sure that the leadership knows what to do. Just as you were talking about this upcoming address by President Bush, we're not sure what he has to say, what possible deals, even the deals that are out there that look, you know, some kind of concerted effort on the part of world leadership. The question is, who takes the lead? Who suggests exactly what is the right prescription? And nobody, including financial leaders, you look at the financial press in this country, you talk to financial leaders, they're not sure where this stops and how to stop it.
And the other point is that Nancy Pelosi is thinking about calling back the Congress after the election to what? Inject more money into the system?
That's right. Now, Speaker Pelosi is raising the possibility of a second stimulus package, about half the size of the one they passed last winter. So this would be about $150 billion. Of course, the one that they passed last winter, the $300 billion stimulus package where we all got our checks, that didn't really seem to have an effect. So I'd be a little bit skeptical about the chances of this package, which is even smaller, really affecting these outcomes. At the basics, Diane, this is a crisis of confidence. In many ways, capitalism is kind of a confidence game. People need to be able to trust other people that they're going to repay loans, that they're going to be paid, and that the prices are the accurate market prices. And right now, there's not a lot of trust in the system.
We did a program just yesterday on capitalism. What's happening to it? I mean, are we moving into a new kind of capitalism the world over?
Well, I don't think capitalism was ever meant to succeed without regulation. And I think what's happened really beginning in the 80s was this drive towards free markets and lift the regulations and, you know, let the markets perform and the markets know better than government. And I think America, you know, led in that effort. And it was primarily driven by Republicans, but Democrats joined in as well. And the rest of the world followed our lead because they thought, you know, we looked successful over here. We had, you know, more yachts and more diamonds, I guess, than others. And that's now, that whole way of operating is now on trial.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Juan Williams, NPR news analyst, Fox News political analyst, and Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Matthew, did Tuesday night's debate do anything to sway independent voters?
Well, if it did one thing, I think it would make those independents more assured of Barack Obama as the president. I think in this debate, we saw the emergence of a presidential Obama. You know, I always look at body language. And during that debate, McCain was darting back and forth while he talked. He was wandering around the stage. Obama would pick a member of the audience, usually the person who had addressed the question to begin with, and he'd kind of plant himself in front of him, and he'd just speak directly to them. He was kind of staid, calm. That's the Obama we've come to know throughout this crisis, whereas you see McCain zigzagging around, as he tends to do. He's very impulsive, impetuous. I got a lot of notes from Republicans Tuesday night, and also some independent-minded people, undecided people, saying this was the night where Obama sealed the deal.
Interesting. What do you think, Juan?
Well, if you were going back to the economy, which is now the number one issue for everyone, if you stopped and thought about what came out of it, there was John McCain making a real effort, I think, to say, I feel your pain, Clinton-esque style, by saying, you know what, let's look at the foreclosure market. Let's look at people who are hurting. I'm willing now to have the government intercede and make sure that these people don't lose their homes. But, you know, he didn't put a lot of meat on the bone as to exactly what did that mean and who would get this kind of government assistance. I thought Obama, on the other hand, was all about making a connection between George W. Bush and John McCain and lack of regulation.
Juan Williams, NPR news analyst, Fox News political analyst, author of numerous books. We'll take a short break, talk more about the debate when we come back. Welcome back to the first hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Juan Williams of NPR, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Isaac, who titles it, A Voter's Dilemma. I don't like either of them. He says, as a religious conservative on many social issues, I find it difficult to support Obama because of his support of abortion and his support of repealing the Defense of Marriage Act. McCain, however, has run such a negative and despicable campaign that I feel like I simply cannot support him. Honesty is a religious matter as well, and I feel as though McCain is showing a willingness to do whatever it takes to win, which disgusts me. What's a guy like me to do, Eleanor?
Well, I can't tell him who to vote for, but I can comment on the McCain campaign. And look, John McCain is running in the wake of the most unpopular president of modern times, at a time when the economy is in a meltdown and when there is economic stress that typically, since the 1930s, helps Democrats. So McCain, rather than trying to offer an economic, positive economic plan and vision, although he has thrown a new proposal in just the last couple of days, he has concluded that he has to raise doubts about Barack Obama so that he, John McCain, becomes the safe harbor for voters. The problem is, as Matthew commented, that his erratic is the term of choice, but his inconsistent behavior on the campaign trail, even in that debate, does not convey a sense of stability to voters who are looking for a steady hand on the tiller.
What about the McCain campaign's continued reference to Barack Obama's, quote, association with William Ayers, Matthew Continetti?
Well, I think it's legitimate to raise the Ayers Association. It's interesting, though, and I think it smacks of desperation that the McCain campaign waited this long. I mean, William Ayers came up during the Democratic primaries between the debates of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And then you had Jeremiah Wright explode onto the scene. McCain never raised the issues of Obama's associations, his friendships in the past, so he waits until the last few weeks before the election to raise them. I think voters are going to kind of recoil from that. I don't know how much impact it would have. If it had been part of a broader message starting in the spring or in June, I think it may have had more effect.
How much legitimacy is there to this association with William Ayers, Juan Williams?
I think it's pretty thin gruel, Diane. You know, clearly there was some association. He was serving on a board, an Annenberg board in Chicago, having to do with school reform. There was a get-to-know-you coffee that was held at Ayers' home for Barack Obama when he was running for his first term in the Illinois State Legislature. So there was some connection. I think Obama has sought to minimize it. Sometimes his opponents have tried to exaggerate it. But it was all part of this Chicago network of liberals that Barack Obama was part of. Do I think that Barack Obama buys into William Ayers' ideology or the fact that he was part of the Weather Underground and involved with bombings in the past? No, I don't think anyone has made that case. But, you know, if you were to extend this to Wright, I think there is a thoroughly legitimate point of association where he was in that church for 20 years. And I think there's no question he knew of the kind of extreme statements, sometimes offensive statements being made by Wright, and chose to have Wright as a mentor and the person who I think he took the title of one of his sermons for his own book. So this is all a question, then, of trying to drive up the risk factor, making it clear that, you know, voters, before you go to the polls, before you end up having sort of buyer's regret, be aware of this person's judgment, be aware that this person will try to deny past associations and the like. That's what John McCain is up to.
Eleanor.
Well, William Ayers, it's been almost 40 years since he committed the acts that Barack Obama has called despicable. He has sat on boards and gotten money from Republican-run organizations. He's on the board of the University of South Carolina. Does that mean that Governor Mark Sanford is somehow palling around with terrorists? Yeah, I just think the voters look at this and think, you know, what is John McCain doing when you've got two wars and economy that's tanking and they're dwelling on this? And in terms of the Reverend Wright issue as well, I mean, John McCain probably didn't really want to address all of this directly. He was hoping other groups would do it, and other groups are doing it. In battleground states, there are plenty of ads that bring this up. And this is the same old, you know, wedge politics, character assassination that voters, I think, have gotten tired of. I mean, that's one of the reasons why Barack Obama has been such a phenomenal political star in this season, because he seems to be a departure from that sort of stuff.
Look, if any Republican candidate had begun his career, as Charles Krauthammer points out in the Post today, at the home of a man who had bombed abortion clinics and was unrepentant about it, they would be driven out of polite company and about polite politics, and it would be every reason that they ought to have been driven out as such. Barack Obama launched his career in the home of William Ayers, who has never said that his association with the Weather Underground was wrong. And so it's legitimate to raise this. I think it comes too late. I don't think it's going to be enough to stop Obama from becoming president, but it is a legitimate issue.
What did you all make of McCain during the debate addressing Obama or referring to Obama as that one, Juan?
Well, I thought it was dismissive. Now, some people have suggested it might be racist, and like, I think it's a little bit extreme. I don't understand. I mean, gosh, I've been in arguments with people done worse than that. But no, to me, it's just, you know, in the middle of a discussion, the way that he chose to refer to him was, I think, less than polite, and that's about it.
Eleanor?
Yes, and it handed a weapon to the Obama campaign. Of the press secretary, Bill Burton, sent out an email saying, did McCain just refer to Obama as that one? I mean, they were kind of disbelieving. And I think now you can probably get a T-shirt that says that one. It's become a way to ridicule John McCain for the sort of desperation that has crept into his campaign.
The question, so many people, I think it was two writers for Politico, wrote a piece titled "The Worst Debate Ever." Matt, how did you feel about it?
Well, I'm not sure it was the worst debate ever or even the worst debate of this campaign season. I think the worst debate of this campaign season was the Des Moines Register Democratic primary debate, where all the contestants, as it were, it was like a game show, had to raise their hands, and you had the moderator, who was just an extremely boring person. This one, however, I thought was funny in this sense, which was that it wasn't the questions that Americans are necessarily interested in. It was the questions that Tom Brokaw was interested in. And we went through an entire debate without any questions about social issues, without any questions about abortion, same-sex marriage, embryonic stem cell research, guns. These are important issues. Many Americans, they're the reasons that they go out and become involved in politics. Instead, we had what I thought was a fairly interesting debate about the economy and about foreign policy. But that's only two parts of kind of the tri-pronged American political debate we have in this country. And I thought it was a big mistake to leave out that third part.
Well, I must say, in defense of the three moderators we've had so far, Jim Lehrer, Gwen Ifill, and Tom Brokaw, to try to get to everything you want in one 90-minute period when you've got your individuals who are involved saying more and taking up more time with each statement can be very difficult.
Yeah, I don't fault the choice of questions. The formats tend to be stifling, and Tom Brokaw, you could see, was trying to break out of it.
He was frustrated.
But he was breaking out of it mostly on his own behalf, because there were a couple of occasions, particularly where I thought Barack Obama had a right to respond to something John McCain said, and Brokaw would cut him off saying, oh, no, you're past your time. And occasionally when the two candidates seemed like they might actually get into an exchange, he would invoke the rules. And you wish that somebody would just break the rules. Maybe that will happen in the last debate. Maybe that's the last weapon that John McCain has left in his arsenal, is to break the rules in a debate.
Juan Williams, to what extent do you believe race is making its way into this campaign?
It's always been in the campaign. I think now, as we sort of get down to the final stretch, there's increased attention to what people call the Bradley factor, or, you know, exactly how much does Barack Obama have to be statistically ahead to be really assured that he has a significant lead that will allow him to
claim
victory.
Explain the Bradley effect.
And the Bradley effect is, with Tom Bradley out in California when he was running against George Duke Majan, had a lead in the polls, but on Election Day, that lead disappeared. We've seen something similar to it here in the East with Governor Doug Wilder of Virginia. When he was running again, had a substantial lead, wins bit by the, you know, hair of his nose or whatever at the last minute. A little bit of it evident with Deval Patrick in Massachusetts, now the governor there. So the question is, how much of a lead do you need as a black candidate running nationwide or statewide in this country? And the thought is it's about 5 percentage points that they're, you know, when you ask white voters point blank, it tends to be about 8% that say, you know, I won't vote for a black person. Well, they're the honest ones. The question is how many are not saying that they won't vote for a black candidate.
Just to inject a couple of notes of skepticism. First of all, if you're going to vote for John McCain, there's no shame in saying you're going to vote for John McCain. It doesn't mean you're a racist. So, I mean, I don't see why people have to lie, number one. Number two, no Democrat has won a majority of the white vote in this country since 1964 with Lyndon Johnson. So a lot of these people haven't been voting Democratic anyway. So, and I think if Obama does win, it's in large part because he will change the face of the electorate. There will be a lot more young people. And for every older person who reflects attitudes of an early generation that he might lose, he's going to pick up two from the younger generation who are race blind and gender neutral.
And now the National Rifle Association has announced it is going to endorse John McCain despite its reservations about him.
That's right. And, you know, maybe too little, maybe too late. And, of course, this is the problem John McCain has always had, as being the maverick, which, of course, is the word that comes up again and again. You don't really get much credit in national politics for being a guy who reaches across the aisle and poking your finger in the eye of your own party. And McCain has broken with his own party, whether it's on guns, whether it's on campaign finance reform, whether it's on detainee interrogations, whether it's on climate change. The list goes on and on. The problem is that it doesn't get him much purchase with Democrats, and it also kind of alienates Republicans. So he's left in the middle, and he's left kind of alone.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. At the same time, the question of race comes up. You've got a new CNN poll asking what voters think of the age difference between the two candidates, Elner.
Well, the CNN poll reflects some nervousness whether John McCain at age 72 would be able to serve out not only two terms but one term. And I think that does raise the bar for his vice presidential choice. And Sarah Palin probably increased her likability in her debate performance, but she did not reassure voters that she is capable of taking on the presidency on a moment's notice. And so I don't think she helps him, and she may even hurt him to some small degree.
Help or hurt, Matthew?
Well, I think it depends about what part of the electorate you're discussing. Does the pick of Sarah Palin help John McCain among values voters, among evangelical conservative Republicans? Absolutely. She has completely shored up that part of his base of support. Does it help among swing voters, among suburbanites, suburban women, those types of voters? I'm not sure so much. I think the doubts about her qualifications, or for me personally, it's less her qualifications than the fact that she's so, it seems, ill-informed about a lot of these national issues. Those sorts of doubts, combined with her social conservatism, I think it's turned off a lot of those suburban women in particular.
Juan Williams.
Well, and I think that her style has come into question this past week. She is really out there. If we're talking about John McCain raising William Ayers and possibly right, Sarah Palin is out there throwing red meat to the far right in this country.
What do you mean?
Well, her rallies down, and you know, we should look, Diane, at where they've sent her. They sent her down to Florida, North Carolina, Virginia. And her rallies become, you know, sort of flag waving, thumping, angry, people shouting at even the crews that are there from the networks and the like. They become
scary.
Well, I don't know. I'll let you describe it as scary, but I think it's just been sort of kind of emotional and harsh in her tone. And it's a real departure from even John McCain. John McCain has not taken it to that level in terms of appealing, I think, to a base element in the Republican Party.
Well, John McCain is coming close to it when he comes out and said, "Who is the real Barack Obama?" You know, with this scary voice. They really are whipping up a level of frenzy among the voters that I think is not responsible.
Matt.
This is a ridiculous argument. Whose voters or supporters are the most enthusiastic in this election and have been throughout this cycle? It's the Democrats. Democrats are very excited. They're the ones that are whipped up. They're the ones that they're in a frenzy of excitement to elect Barack Obama, the President of the United States. What we have here are a few anecdotes by campaign reporters who have been on the trail for months now and want to find something interesting. And so, of course, you're going to find jerks at Republican rallies. You're going to find jerks at Democratic rallies. But it's the Republican stories, because it feeds into this preconceived narrative of whipping up the angry white voters, that are going to be publicized.
But,
I think it's absurd.
You know, honestly, to be factual, Matthew, I don't think anybody at a Democratic rally has stood up and said, kill him.
Well, kill, I mean, I think there are plenty of Democrats, Diane, who feel that way about George W. Bush, for example. I mean, we don't know. That's the fact that they're not being reported.
It's not being vocalized. And
we have one
story. Well, nobody likes to talk about the fear of assassination, but it is out there. And when you have the other side talking about somebody who's not patriotic, that he's palling around with terrorism. I mean, that is flirting with very dangerous rhetoric. And I think it turns off people on McCain. He may have lost this election narrowly. This may give him a huge loss because this is just over the top in the
Juan
eyes
Williams.
Of many Americans.
You know, I happen to think that it's beyond just the hardcore, the base showing passion. I agree with Matthew that you can see some awful things that people, anything you say about Barack Obama means that you're a bad person because Barack Obama is supposed to be, beyond reproach. But the idea of, yelling racial epithets and kill him and the like, to me, it's offensive.
Juan Williams of NPR News, and he's also a Fox News political analyst. His latest book, Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., home of Operation Spy, where museum visitors are the spies. Tickets at opspy.com. And from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. A draft U.S. intelligence report questions the ability of the Afghan government to deal with rising violence, leading central banks lower interest rates as the financial crisis grows around the world, and a federal judge orders some Guantanamo prisoners released. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go right ahead,
okay.
Sir.
Yeah, I'm an Obama supporter, but I've been looking for undecided voters for the last two or three weeks, finding darn few of them. But the big question I have that maybe you and your experts can answer is, what did the single-issue voters actually get during the last 8 years of the Republican administration? What actual federal legislation was passed for the abortion rights people, for the gun people, for the evangelical vote, et cetera? And whether or not some of the pundits are correct in that they're really really trying to divide voting blocks with these issues and possibly not really walking the walk after they talk the talk.
Matt.
Well, I think social conservatives can look at the two Supreme Court appointments. They can look at the partial birth abortion ban. They can look at Bush's vetoes of embryonic cells, stem cell research, as examples of places where he really did come through for social conservatives. Of course, most of Congress has backed gun rights. I mean, now that's the two issues on which you can actually see, or two kind of groups of issues on which you can see public opinion moving in a more conservative direction. There are only two of them in my mind. One of them is on abortion, and the other one is on gun rights. Voters are more willing to restrict abortion, and they are less willing to restrict gun rights. And so it's the Democrats have moved on one set of issues, the guns, but they haven't on the others. And that's why I think they are legitimate to raise in elections.
Elner.
Well, it's all about the Supreme Court, and the next president will get at least one appointment and could get as many as three. And with the court evenly divided between conservatives and liberals with one swing vote in the middle, the next president could have a decisive impact on the court and on social policy for the next generation.
I would just quickly add,
sure.
Of course, that the faith-based initiative has become a major feature, if you were to talk to the Bush administration, of what they see as their legacy, and Barack Obama has embraced that. The whole notion that money, federal money, should flow into church-based organizations to help with social issues in the country. And the other thing I would say is that, I forget, is it Terri Schiavo, who was the young woman, and the clear stand that the Republicans took on that issue, which is related to abortion by extension. And finally, on vouchers, that President Bush has been very aggressive in terms of saying that he's willing to, for the school reform movement, people who are at the edge of that, which I think is a major issue of our time, been very aggressive on that front.
Well, just to mention briefly, the stand that the Republican Congress and the president took on Terri Schiavo completely backfired.
Right.
Republicans didn't like it. Even self-identified evangelicals thought it was an improper interference.
All right, let's go to Dayton, Ohio. James, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was so happy the other night when I watched the debate and Tom Brokaw posed a question that I was hoping someone would pose to these candidates. Regarding health care, whether or not, although he did muddle it a bit, I never had heard it put this way with the third category, whether or not health care was a privilege, a right, or a responsibility. Responsibility, I think, is another fancy way of saying it's a privilege. And naturally, Senator McCain said it was a responsibility. And I was so happy to hear Barack Obama say that it was a right. And I think that until our country has lost our moral bearing and we're no longer concerned about what is the common good, and I think until we finally realize that our health care system has to be a single-payer system, not only for the health of the physical health of our country, but for the financial health of our country.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. How much is health care going to determine what voters do next month want?
It's the number two issue in the country right now, right behind the economy. I say that with a little bit of amusement because, gosh, you know, the war in Iraq, if we had been here a year ago, would have been the dominant issue of our day. And it has faded now. I think it's not even in the top five. It's really curious about that.
And yet it's still sucking up $10 to $12 billion a month.
Exactly.
And we've got to start paying attention to Afghanistan, which is another war we're on the verge of losing.
Here's an email from John who says, I'm reading several articles about the illegal NSA wiretaps made on American citizens under the surveillance program instituted by President Bush. On many occasions, the president stressed this was all done according to law. Now we're learning many on the left and many right-leaning civil libertarians were dead on when they claimed the Bush administration stepped over the legal line. This is now being brought forth into the daylight by former NSA employees who are coming forth and telling the truth. I should tell you all that author James Bamford is going to be on this program next Wednesday to talk about this very issue. Matt Continetti, what do you say to this listener?
Well, I mean, if there are questions of abuse among the people involved in administrating the terrorist surveillance program, then, yeah, that's illegal and they should stop it. I think the program as a whole is legal, and I do think that Barack Obama is not going to shut it down. Barack Obama this summer angered a lot of people on the left when he voted for a bill basically codifying the program, and which included immunity for telecommunications companies that participated in it. And this is a it gives me 2 points. One is that a lot of what we debate about in the Bush administration, some of the fundamental changes in policy he made, they're going to exist beyond him, no matter who is president. And the second point I'd make is that even a lot of Obama supporters don't really have a sense of who he is. He has really moved toward the center since he wrapped up the Democratic nomination. I don't think he's going to really enact the grand fundamental change he talks about. He's an incrementalist. He's a gradualist. And he's going to keep a lot of the Bush administration's legacy.
Hell no.
Keep a lot of the Bush administration legacy, other than what you just mentioned, which was a bill he voted against before he voted for it, and is for it with appropriate judicial review and oversight, I believe. Barack Obama has moved to the center, as most successful presidential candidates do, and John McCain has done it as well in an effort to win, because you don't win by simply rallying your base. You have to win those up-for-grabs voters, and that's become the definition of success in the debates. Whoever wins the undecideds seems to win the debates.
Let's go now to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diana, and good morning to your panel.
Hi.
I think maybe Juan's book, Enough, is appropriate for how I'm feeling right now. I'm curious, when are voters going to realize that our so-called leaders do not represent us? And I'm just surprised there aren't more people who are just outraged. I mean, we have global markets melting. You know, the Dow fell below 8,000 earlier today. We're $10 trillion in debt, and we're treated to a so-called debate, which is really like an artificial vehicle for the candidates to recite their stump speeches. And I vote for none of the above. We've really been treated to, in the past month, it's fairly obvious that our leaders have abandoned any leadership responsibility.
Yeah, I'm not with this caller. I mean, I think John McCain and Barack Obama are men of character and principle, and I have heard far few comments that I'm going to hold my nose and vote for one or the other. I'm voting for the lesser of two evils. I mean, I think this is a pretty clear choice. And, they're out there not giving us ambitious plans for what they would do to rescue the economy, because they're not president yet, and they don't want to interfere with the very delicate machinations that are going on. But I think once the election is over, I would hope whoever is the winner steps up pretty quickly, announces their economic team, the national security team, gets a commitment from Congress to confirm those people pretty quickly, and that we get a sense of some strong leadership in Washington once again.
Why?
Well, I think that the caller's exactly right. I think that that last debate, if you were to criticize it as a really terrible debate, the worst debate, you'd say it's because they keep reciting the same things. You could have heard everything that they said, and there's very little that's new. And what's new tends to be rather frothy without any heart to it. You think, well, what is he trying to say? What is he trying to do? Or is it just political maneuvering? So here I'm referring to McCain's effort to say he's going to help people avoid foreclosure. So, I mean, when you think about the kind of anger that we've seen on the bailout bill, you know, where is the representation of that as a legitimate issue? Why are we giving money to the rich? And then someone will say, well, we need to stabilize the financial markets, but the financial markets are not being stabilized. So, no, I don't think they have picked up on this. And to me, you know, when you think about the big issues, it looks right now like both are playing defense. Both are trying to be safe. Obviously, McCain, looking at the numbers, looking at the economic environment, understands that he's at a terrific disadvantage, which is what's forcing his hand in terms of these negative attacks. But both of them, it seems to me, are rather cautious. And with regard to the economic policies, I haven't seen anything by way of sort of innovation or even coming from their advisors. They talk now about making Warren Buffett Secretary of the Treasury, that kind of thing. I think, come on, guys. You know, if you really have some innovative thinking to put on the table, let's do it.
Let me see if I can understand the half hour that Obama has purchased just a few days before the election. It's on October 29th, which is the anniversary of the Wall Street crash. Why did he do this? What's he going to use it for, Elner?
Well, I think he's going to use it to deliver a presidential address, because I think he's hoping that that will be that will finally seal the deal, that if the polls are looking as good as they are today, that he is the likely next president. And maybe he will go a little further to outline his plan. I mean, he has put a lot of ideas on the table about investing in infrastructure to get jobs going, to have a real energy plan, and he's put some teeth in those things. What he hasn't got is a sort of a slogan, sort of a programmatic way to tie all his policies together. But they're basically progressive, mainstream, democratic proposals, and I don't think there are any magic bullets for turning this around quickly, and he's going to have a very difficult time.
By the way, President Bush has said this morning the rescue plan is aggressive and big enough, but it will take time to work. Matt?
Just a quick point on this money buy, the television buy. It shows Obama's enormous financial advantage. I live in Virginia, a swing state now. Virginia hasn't voted for a Democrat since 1964, and it probably will vote for a Democrat in 2008. And you can watch television, a sporting event. You can see five Obama ads in a few hours. You won't see a single McCain ad. McCain has to send Sarah Palin to rally in Virginia. Virginia! And she has to go to North Carolina. These are places that are Republican strongholds. And you do get that sense from that campaign that things are slowly slipping out of their control.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Errol, who's in Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. I just had a quick question. Is it that this time that we're living in, is this similar to past times when there is an opportunity out there for people to buy stock at lows, similar to when people bought IBM in the 30s at a nickel a share? Is this one of those seminal moments in our history when people can truly get into investment vehicles that they'll be able to retire on when they're young?
If you've got courage,
and if you can spot the next IBM,
yeah.
I would look in energy independent areas, and I would look in health areas, but I'm not smart enough to figure that out.
If you're investing for the long term, absolutely. I mean, you don't bet against the United States of America's economy. I mean, it's gone through these periods before. It goes through these periods about once every 10 years, in fact. Over the last 25 years, we have been in recession only twice, and they have been the shortest and shallowest recessions in American history. The fundamentals are strong in this economy, even though we're going through a really bad panic.
The last couple of recessions have not seen anything like the tumult we're seeing
today.
And
I'm not saying that this one
won't
be bad.
Please, you didn't
Eleanor.
See previous presidents virtually nationalizing major financial institutions.
That's true.
I think the key here
different.
Is if I said, hey, Diane, lend me $10, you'd say, wait a second, what's going on right now? How much confidence do you have that Juan is going to pay you back that $10? And it's similar when you think about stocks. You think, well, exactly how many bad assets does this company have that I might not be aware of because these corporate leaders have been lying on their profit and loss sheets, and so we don't know. So you say, is it a good time to hunt out value stocks? Well, you don't know exactly what it's worth. You don't know
exactly
if it's a true value stock,
exactly.
And that's why the market goes down. You hear President Bush and others say, oh, we're getting insurance for the banks, and we're getting insurance for people who have deposits in banks. It's all meant to reassure, to build up your confidence. But the confidence is not there as we speak this morning.
Here's a last question from a listener who says, you've spent all kinds of time on the charges that Obama associates with terrorists. You've said nothing about the Alaska independence movement that the Palins support.
That came out early in a New York Times report that Sarah Palin was a member of that party, and it was the party's leader claiming that. That turned out to be wrong. The New York Times did a correction, and subsequent to that, it's now appeared that she has spoken at this organization, and it's a pretty radical group, and they favor secession from the United States. It really is an independence movement to the extremes. She has apparently tried to conceal her connections to the group. Her husband was a member.
Juan?
Her husband was a member, and again, the idea is you're looking at extremist politics, political extremism, but it's apparently the case that I think her opponents would say that Sarah Palin and these folks were involved in political expediency, that they were playing to some anger in the part of Alaskan voters, and that now she is in this national stage. She doesn't want to own up to it.
There's a difference between the Alaska Independence Party, which may be radical, and the Weather Underground. And that's the Alaska Independence Party doesn't try to blow up the Pentagon. I mean, that's why it's a more legitimate issue.
But
I mean,
Bill Ayers isn't running for vice president.
it's apples and oranges. One is a legitimate political party that people subscribe to, even though they may have crazy views, and the other is a terrorist group. They're two different things.
Well, it's questioning associations, what they say about the candidate's character. And actually, the Obama campaign has retaliated by reminding people about John McCain's association with Charles Keating and the savings and loan scandals of the late 1980s. And it's a game that the voters are not really interested in.
And as games go, I think that one is a pretty lame one. Elner Clift of Newsweek, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. He's editor of the magazine's Campaign Standard blog. Juan Williams, NPR analyst and Fox News political analyst. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner.